Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Liv Little, l'animatrice de Why I Move, s'est associée à elle et Nike pour proposer un podcast qui va vous redonner le pouvoir, vous motiver et toutes nous maintenir en mouvement. Liv discutera avec certaines de ses personnalités préférées issues du monde de la mode, de la culture et du sport pour découvrir ce qui les fait bouger et pourquoi. Vous entendrez également les entraîneurs et formateurs Nike qui viendront valider les conseils donnés. Alors, faites une pause, inspirez profondément et écoutez Why I Move. Vous êtes prêtes ?
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 30th of January. The US warns it will deliver a powerful response to the killing of three American soldiers by suspected Iranian-backed militants.
We will respond decisively to any aggression, and we will hold responsible the people who attacked our troops. We'll do so at a time and a place of our choosing.
However, Washington has stressed it does not want a war with Iran. French farmers bring their tractors to Paris to protest against falling incomes, and why you can't search for Taylor Swift on X or Twitter. Also in the podcast, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court says both sides in Sudan's civil war appear to be committing war crimes in the Darfur region. And
this shark was actually completely white in color. I was looking at the video, I'm like, the fins, they're differently shaped. I'm like, that's not an older white shark, that's a very young white shark. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this could be a newborn.
Was this the youngest great white ever filmed? A day after he announced the deaths of three American soldiers in the Middle East, the US President Joe Biden is under pressure to act against the Iranian-backed militants that he blamed for the drone strike. At least two senior Republicans called for the US to hit Iran directly, though others cautioned that that could lead to a dangerous escalation. On Monday, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said there would be a significant response.
We've taken steps to defend ourselves and to defend our partners, as well as to prevent escalation. And the president's been crystal clear. We will respond decisively to any aggression, and we will hold responsible the people who attacked our troops. We'll do so at a time and a place of our choosing.
Antony Blinken. Iran has denied direct involvement in the attack, which an Iranian-backed group called Islamic Resistance in Iraq said it carried out. With more details on the group and exactly what happened in the attack near the Jordan-Syria border, here's our Middle East correspondent Quentin Somerville.
The drone struck in the early hours while troops were in their sleeping quarters at the outpost known as Tower 22. A US defence official said it came in very low and very slow. At the same time, an American drone was returning to base, which meant air defences weren't able to stop it. Islamic Resistance in Iraq is a new group, formed at the start of the Israel-Hamas war, it said, in support of the people of Gaza. But its members have for years targeted US sites in Iraq and Syria. The number and sophistication of the strikes has increased dramatically since October. America has responded with airstrikes of its own in Iraq, including a drone attack in Baghdad at the beginning of the month, which killed a senior militant commander. But Iran's proxies remain undeterred. America has maintained a network of military outposts across eastern Syria, western Iraq and in Jordan, some 6,500 troops, since the downfall of the Islamic State group, ostensibly to prevent the group's return. The killing of Americans will only add to fears across the Middle East that the war in Gaza will escalate into a wider conflict, and politicians and diplomats across the region worry that as the US election draws closer, President Biden's ability to negotiate a truce is narrowing. Like the pro-Iranian Lebanese group Hezbollah, IRI suspended attacks during November's one-week truce in Gaza, but resumed its strikes when that ended.
Quentin Somerville in Beirut. So what might the reaction from the US look like? Our correspondent in Washington is Tom Bateman.
Well, everyone so far in Washington has been trying to find out the answer to that. And there have been various officials from the administration who have been on the podium at various different briefings. I mean, there was Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary. We then heard from John Kirby, the spokesman for the National Security Council. But we don't know the details. Remember that Iran hawks in Washington, particularly Republicans on Capitol Hill, calling for action against Iran itself, so strikes inside Iran. Now, that's not a surprising message, but it ramps up the pressure on President Biden, you know, and this is sort of critically important in a presidential year whose opponents have already portrayed him as weak on this issue. So the administration knows that it needs to show something, but it has to hold the line to this policy of not trying to ignite a much wider war in the region. That's going to be an extremely difficult thing to achieve. President Biden met with his national security officials twice yesterday. They will have presented him with a menu of options, ranging from the kinds of responses that we've seen so far by the US on Iran-backed militias, both in Syria and Iraq, to probably much more focused, targeted killings of IRGC or Iranian Revolutionary Guard senior figures, right up through to attacks on Iranian soil. But that's obviously going to be that, the response that they will be trying to calibrate, trying to avert a wider conflict, but at the same time showing that they've responded forcefully.
Tom Bateman in Washington. Meanwhile, more big donors have halted funding for UN aid work in Gaza after Israel said about a dozen members of staff of the UN Agency for Palestinians, UNRWA, had taken part in the Hamas massacre of the 7th of October. On Monday, Austria and Japan joined the likes of the US, France, Britain and Germany, who have already paused their financial contributions. At the same time, new details have emerged from the Israeli intelligence dossier on the alleged militants. Here's Lipika Pelham from our Middle East desk.
The contents of the Israeli dossier were first reported by the New York Times. The six-page document says that intelligence showed nearly 200 UNRWA workers, including teachers, were Hamas or Islamic Jihad operatives without providing detailed evidence. It said that at least 12 workers crossed into Israel on the 7th of October. Of those, a schoolteacher and his son from Khan Yunis in southern Gaza were alleged to have helped in the abduction of an Israeli woman. Another two were said to have participated in raids on southern Israeli farming communities. An UNRWA social worker from Nusayrat in central Gaza is accused of unspecified involvement in the transfer to Gaza of the body of a dead Israeli soldier and of coordinating the movements of pickup trucks used by Hamas and other infiltrators. One of the accused is also alleged to have armed himself with an anti-tank missile. The dossier reportedly claims that Israel's intelligence is based on tracking the phones of six of the people, monitoring the phone calls by others who allegedly discussed their involvement in the attack, and text messages received by another three, including one ordering him to bring rocket-propelled grenades stored in his house. UNRWA, which employs 13,000 people in Gaza, has sacked 9 employees over the allegations, which, it says, it is still investigating.
Lipika Pelham. The US has said it's important not to blame all UNRWA staff and that the agency had helped save thousands of lives in Gaza. UNRWA says if the funding freeze continues, it will have to cease its work as early as next month. As many as 2 million people in Gaza are reliant on the agency for humanitarian assistance and shelter. One of them is Ghada Al-Kurd, a freelance journalist from Gaza City. She and her family were displaced to Khan Yunis, where they stayed in an UNRWA shelter. She spoke to Tim Franks from Rafah.
We've been in a shelter for 3 months. UNRWA actually was providing us with shelter, water, food, humanitarian aid, some medical supplies. The building, it has a big yard, so we can build tents inside this yard. There were many of UNRWA schools beside us, so they were providing many assistance for these schools.
Before October the 7th, did you or your family have any reliance on the services that UNRWA provided?
For some periods, we have some humanitarian aid from UNRWA. Our children, they are learning inside UNRWA schools. If we are sick, we are going to the UNRWA clinics, and we have free medication for chronic disease, diabetes, high blood pressure. And if we have blood tests, we are going, and for pregnancy, actually, for women. So we can go to this clinic and we have good medical care.
If UNRWA had to stop operating, do you think that other humanitarian agencies could begin to replace what UNRWA does?
UNRWA has been working in Palestinian territories since 75 years. So most of the people are depending on aids and support from UNRWA. If it will be cut with the hunger and the starvation because of what the people are facing right now, it will increase this catastrophe for displaced people. People need UNRWA immediate time now. So cutting the support from UNRWA, it will be a big problem for people here.
Ghada Al-Kurd talking to Tim Franks. There are grounds to believe that war crimes are being committed in the Darfur region of Sudan, according to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. Karim Khan said it was his clear assessment that both the army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, were carrying out crimes in Darfur. He was briefing the UN Security Council during a visit to refugee camps in Chad. More than 13,000 people have been killed and over 10 million displaced since fighting broke out between Sudan's armed forces and the RSF. The BBC's Anne Soy reports from Nairobi.
Karim Khan told the Security Council his investigations will centre on Al Janina in Darfur, where hundreds of non-Arab people were targeted, killed, women raped, and their homes set on fire. The attacks were condemned internationally as having the hallmarks of ethnic cleansing and echoing atrocities committed nearly two decades ago in the same region. The prosecutor said the failure to deliver justice then had invigorated a climate of impunity now. He appealed for access to the country to conduct investigations. The Sudanese government, he said, has not answered 35 requests for assistance from his office. Meanwhile, the US has designated the interior minister who served under former President Omar al-Bashir, Ahmed Mohamed Haroun, offering a reward of $5 million for information leading to his arrest over past war crimes in Darfur.
And that was Anne Soy reporting. Taylor Swift featured prominently in TV coverage of the American Football Conference Championship game on Sunday. But type her name into X or Twitter and a message pops up. Something went wrong, try reloading. The social media giant blocked searches after explicit fake images of the star were posted to the site. One was reportedly viewed 47 million times. It's just the latest example of the proliferation of AI-generated images and audio clips of celebrities and politicians. The BBC's Nick Robinson asked an expert in deepfakes, Professor Hani Farid, whether he welcomed the action taken by X.
It's not nearly enough, because what you have to understand about this type of content is there are many players in the field that enable it. There's, of course, the underlying technology that creates the content. There's the people creating the content. There's the platforms distributing the content. But there's also the financial institutions that allow these companies to monetize it, Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, American Express. There's the Googles of the world, where if you go to Google and you search, find me deep fake nudes of Taylor Swift, it will gladly surface it. So there's a whole infrastructure that is profiting off of this digital violence against women. And so, great, you're going to deal with it for now, but we know that this problem is going to persist, and we're late to the game, as we often are when it comes to these online harms. Deepfakes hit the scene maybe in 2016 or so, but the images and the video and the audio weren't very good, very grainy, and didn't look very realistic. And what has happened over the years is a few things. The content is looking more and more realistic. But what's also happened is it's not just the Taylor Swifts that are vulnerable to this. It's also anybody who has a single image of themselves online can now be inserted into sexually explicit material. And then, of course, that content can be carpet bombed across the internet.
And this year, with more elections across the globe than ever before, it can be used in politics.
We have seen it in Slovakia, in Bangladesh. We're seeing it in Mexico. And we saw it here last week. Here in the United States, we have our first primary in New Hampshire. The day before election, there were robocalls in the state of New Hampshire by what sounded like President Biden telling people not to vote in the primary and to save their vote for the national election. Clear, unambiguous attempt to manipulate our elections.
A robocall, you mean an automated telephone call? So when you pick up the phone, you think the president residents on the line.
Correct. I mean, I think people thought it was a recording, of course. But nonetheless, you know, you hear a call and it's very easy to manipulate voters. And in fact, you don't have to manipulate many voters. National elections here in the U.S. are made or lost with tens of thousands of votes. You don't have to move millions. You have to move thousands.
In order to deal with this, is this legislation to say to all these corporations, you must refuse to take these sites and to take this money?
We need a lot of things. We need education. We need people to understand they're being manipulated. I think we have to hold the various infrastructures that are allowing this type of technology to be created and distributed responsible. And you are 100% right that this is a global response. The U.S. is 5% of the world's population. We can't police 95% of the internet outside the U.S. So we need global cooperation to hold these companies responsible for the harms that they are producing to individuals, societies, and democracies.
Hani Farid, Professor of Computer Science at the University of California, Berkeley, talking to Nick Robinson. Very little is known about how great white sharks reproduce. However, a YouTuber and drone operator may have taken a video of something never seen before, a newborn great white. The details were published in the Journal of Environmental Biology of Fishes. James Clayton in California has this report.
Victoria is swimming in the cool Pacific Ocean, just south of Santa Barbara. Floating in the calm water, she's totally oblivious to who she's sharing the water with. In fact, there's not one, but four great white sharks swimming at this beach. We know this because Carlos Gauna has been flying his drone here all day. The fin of one shark breaks the water.
She's out. Look at that thing. You can see it good.
Carlos is a YouTuber and shark fanatic who is frankly amazing at finding sharks with his drone. The shark is about 60 meters away, but it's really difficult to see.
So from here, you have no idea there was a great white shark out there because it's almost impossible to see it from the beach. And that's why drones are so important, because you have to be almost on top of it to actually see them.
So drones, when you're viewing a shark, you're basically viewing the sharks through a magnifying glass that they don't know is watching them.
Finding a shark, though, isn't always easy.
Go. Sometimes those pieces of kelp floating trick you into thinking it's a shark. Did you hear the ding? We got a shark.
Yeah. From the sky, Carlos captures moments that would be hard to see with the naked eye. Scientists who are also interested in Carlos's footage have taken an interest. Phil Stearns is a local marine biologist and researcher at the University of California, Riverside. He was with Carlos when they stumbled across something they'd never seen before.
So I'm like, either that shark's eating very well, or it might be carrying some pups inside.
The female just was acting erratically. She dove, disappeared, and guess what came up from underneath? This little bitty white, almost albino-looking white shark.
So it's called a white shark. You know, that's the species. It's a white shark. But this shark was actually completely white in color. I was looking at the video. I'm like, the fins, they're differently shaped. They're more rounded. I'm like, that's not an older white shark. That's a very young white shark. This could be a newborn. I'm like, oh my goodness, this could be a newborn.
One of the greatest mysteries in great white shark science is reproduction.
The holy grail of white shark research is the birth of a great white shark. And I believe that that is probably the closest we've ever been to the actual birth of a great white shark.
Other experts like Chris Lowe, a shark scientist at California State University, Long Beach, accept that this could be a historic discovery, but they need to see more evidence.
The problem that I have as a scientist is what we call a sample size of one. Sure, this could be a newborn shark, or it could be a shark with a skin disease. And a lot of people ask, well, what would it take to convince you that this is a pumping area? And I would say I would need to see babies coming out of a female.
Chris Lowe ending that report by James Clayton in California. Now, it's nearly 2 years since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The conflict is no longer at the top of the news agenda, but it could still pose an existential threat to us all, at least if the Ukrainian president is to be believed. Volodymyr Zelensky has said that fighting will escalate into a third world war if Russian aggression isn't contained in Ukraine. There is currently little sign of Russia being defeated on the battlefield there. So where does the war go from here? Well, to coincide with the second anniversary on the 24th of February, we are going to join forces with our friends at Ukrainecast to answer any questions you may have. So if there's something you'd like to know about the fighting in Ukraine or the situation in Russia, please email us and record a voice note if you can so we can play it in the podcast. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you can also tweet us on X at Global News Pod. Still to come on the Global News Pod, the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak lets us in on a secret.
I tend to try and do some fasting at the beginning of every week as part of a general balanced lifestyle, but I also have a weakness for sugary things, which I indulge in the rest of the week.
We'll hear about the pros and cons of fasting. Across Europe in recent weeks, farmers have downed tools and blocked roads in protest at national and EU policies they think are making them poorer. On Monday, there were demonstrations in Belgium and Germany, and a big one in France. The French farmers used their tractors to block major motorways around Paris to try to seal off the capital. They're angry at what they see as low prices for their produce, the high cost of environmental regulation and unfair competition from cheaper imports. Pascal Desprez is a grain farmer involved in the demonstration.
We're here because we're honestly unhappy with the current policies in terms of agriculture. We're especially overwhelmed with rules that prevent us from working and that lower our yields. And so we're calling on Macron to put in place more realistic rules or even remove them altogether. That would be great progress.
Well, our correspondent Bethany Bell spoke to me from a motorway on the northeast outskirts of Paris.
Another tractor has just pulled up in front of me, bringing yet another great big bale of hay to join the great blockade of hay bales, which is completely blocking this major motorway, which is very close to Charles de Gaulle Airport. Every so often we see planes flying over from there. And behind these great bales of hay, which have got flags on top of them, is an enormous line of tractors stretching as far back as I can see, with blinking lights on. And farmers, they say they'll stay here simply as long as it takes, because they see this situation as being untenable. One man told me, we cannot live from our work.
Now, you said you were relatively near Charles de Gaulle Airport. I thought the French authorities were ring-fencing that so that it could stay open.
We do understand that the road between Charles de Gaulle and central Paris is being ring-fenced, but this is the A1 motorway between Paris and Lille, which is well and truly blocked at this moment.
Yeah, quite a busy route on a normal day, I imagine. What is the impact of this protest on other people in France?
There's been a great deal of disruption because there are a number of different blockades like this in the area around Paris. And what the farmers say they want to do is to prevent food being delivered into the capital. And one farmer even said they wanted Paris to starve in order to make their demands felt.
Now, this is a part of a wider movement across Europe. Is this something that's going to have to be addressed in Brussels?
Yes, it's certainly. We've seen similar protests happening in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Germany, here within France as well. There are many demands being made by farmers. And what we seem to be hearing a lot of is a complaint that there's low food prices and that the recent push by the government to bring down costs for consumers has left them struggling to cope. They also don't like competition from other countries that have lower environmental standards, and many of them saying that this is something that really needs to be addressed.
Bethany Bell on the outskirts of the French capital. Spanish police have arrested the owners and staff at a funeral parlour in Valencia for allegedly selling dead bodies to universities for research. The four men are also accused of profiting from the disposal of the bodies after they've been dissected. Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard has the details.
The police account describes a lucrative, if macabre, trade. The gang is said to have targeted people who had no known relatives and who died in hospitals and old people's homes. Those who'd lived in precarious circumstances, and preferably foreigners. Police say the gang falsified documents, then sold each corpse for research for $1,300. They're alleged to have made more money by charging universities to incinerate the dissected cadavers. One university paid more than $5,000 to burn 11 bodies. Police suspect the men of putting body parts in other people's coffins before cremation, saving money in the process.
Danny Eberhard. The Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, has announced details of a proposed partnership with African countries, covering energy, investment and agreements on migration. She presented what's called the Mattei Plan to Parliament and a summit of African leaders. Her government says it will commit $6 billion initially. Leo Goretti is head of the Italian Foreign Policy Programme at the Institute for International Affairs in Rome. Tim Franks asked what part of the plan had caught his eye.
The idea is quite interesting and innovative in that Italy is trying to present itself as a protagonist in reshaping the relationship with Africa. This is obviously due to concerns about migration in the country as well as a wider geopolitical and geoeconomic vision. The real point is exactly what kind of projects this plan will encompass and especially whether Italy will be able to gather other partners around it. Because, to be frank, Italy on its own, and the Prime Minister Meloni is well aware of that, doesn't have the resources, the capabilities, the expertise to put forward a plan for a continent which nowadays has about 1.5 billion people.
Yeah, absolutely fair point that, you know, $6 billion may sound like a fair amount, but given what a huge issue migration from Africa to southern Europe is, you might wonder how much difference it would make. She did have the European Commission president alongside her. Does that suggest there could be wider support?
She has a very good relationship with a European Commission president, Ursula von der Leyen. The real point, however, is to check whether the other big European countries, and I'm thinking especially about France and Germany here, will follow suit. And this may be one of the concerns, perhaps, of this project that's involving multilateral institutions. It remains to be seen whether the key partners in Europe for Italy, also given the focus on the southern shores of the Mediterranean, will be involved too, or whether this will actually create some kind of competition in the relationship with African countries, which would be overall detrimental to the interest of everyone and Italy itself.
And what sort of African countries appear to be on board with her plans?
Italy has developed over the years very strong energy relationship with some North African countries, Algeria, Morocco, Egypt as well, Libya, as well as some countries lately in sub-Saharan Africa, the Republic of the Congo, Mozambique, and there were also projects announced with the Ivory Coast, for example, or Ethiopia. The point, however, is that at the summit today, there were representatives from key countries in the Sahel, like Burkina, Niger, or Mali, and even not representatives from Nigeria, which is the most populous and one of the key actors, obviously, in that scenario. So obviously, the number of partners which have been involved is substantial. There were 46 countries represented today, but there are still some gaps which would need to be filled.
Leo Goretti of the Institute for International Affairs in Rome. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, doesn't talk much about his personal life, though the teetotaler admits to a couple of vices, like eating peppermint bark chocolate and drinking Mexican Coca-Cola made with cane sugar. Now, though, he's revealed that he doesn't eat at all for 36 hours at the start of every week, fasting from 5 p.m. on a Sunday until 5 a.m. on Tuesday. As Siobhan Leahy reports, he's been talking about it to the BBC.
I'm not sure people are that interested in my diet, but I tend to try and do some fasting at the beginning of every week as part of a general balanced lifestyle. But I also have a weakness for sugary things, which I indulge in the rest of the week.
Many have wondered if fasting was part of his Hindu religion or just part of his fitness regime, or maybe both. Sita Suchak is a teacher at the Hindu Academy in London. She explains the Hindu principles behind fasting.
The reason why we do fasting is we want to show discipline over ourselves. We want to say that we are not just a physical body, there is something more to us. And what we'd like to do whenever we participate in fasting is to say, you know what, body, I am in control of you and you are not in control of me. So I don't have to eat and drink anything and everything that is in sight. The wonderful thing in Hinduism is that there is no set injunction saying everyone must fast, because it's a very personal decision whether you want to fast or if you don't want to even fast at all.
Dr. Sarah Jarvis is a clinical consultant for patient.info. She says that intermittent fasting may improve the health of your gut bacteria and explains just how fasting works.
What's happening when you fast is your body is using different compounds for their energy source. For the first few hours, then your body is pulling out what's called glycogen stores in your fat cells, and they're providing energy because those carbohydrates, which normally our bodies use for energy, are not there. What then happens between sort of 12 and 36 hours later is you start using ketones. You're in a state of ketosis, and it's at that stage that it's not necessarily as helpful, and there may well be more risks to it.
Doctors stress that if you're thinking about fasting, then get some medical advice first.
That report by Siobhan Leahy. Finally, the legendary singer Joni Mitchell will perform for the first time at the Grammy Awards in Los Angeles this weekend, almost 9 years after a near-fatal illness left her having to relearn how to walk and play the guitar. The Canadian-born singer-songwriter only recently returned to performing. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson has the story.
I've looked at clouds from both sides now.
Joni Mitchell first won a Grammy in March 1970 when Clouds was named Best Folk Performance. This Sunday, almost 54 years later, and at the age of 80, she is going to make her Grammy's debut as a performer on a lineup including Billie Eilish, Dua Lipa, and the Nigerian Afrofusion star Burna Boy.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't.
This is Joni Mitchell's latest step in a remarkable comeback after suffering a brain aneurysm in 2015, which left her having to learn to walk again. Music played a huge part in her recovery, with Joni jams taking place in her Laurel Canyon home, organised by the singer Brandi Carlile, who recruited the likes of Elton John, Paul McCartney and Herbie Hancock to come and play in her living room.
Joni Mitchell, Archives, Volume 1.
By 2022, she was well enough to go on stage at the Grammys after winning Best Historical Album. It was telling that her acceptance speech included a special mention for someone crucial to her rehabilitation.
So Tune here, who is my physical therapist and who's my angel.
Later that year, she performed in public for the first time since her aneurysm as a surprise guest at the Newport Folk Festival.
I could drink a case of you.
And a live album of that concert is nominated for Best Folk Album at the Grammys, so she could win again as well as play. Although one interesting point of note, Joni Mitchell isn't the oldest person in that category. She's up against Paul Simon, who's 82.
And that was Colin Patterson reporting. That is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Liv Little, l'animatrice de Why I Move, s'est associée à elle et Nike pour proposer un podcast qui va vous redonner le pouvoir, vous motiver et toutes nous maintenir en mouvement. Liv discutera avec certaines de ses personnalités préférées issues du monde de la mode, de la culture et du sport pour découvrir ce qui les fait bouger et pourquoi. Vous entendrez également les entraîneurs et formateurs Nike qui viendront valider les conseils donnés. Alors, faites une pause, inspirez profondément et écoutez Why I Move. Vous êtes prêtes ?